You might like to have Mark chapter 5 open in front of you. If you've got a church Bible, it's on page 1007. When Alexander Litvinenko moved to London with his family 6 years ago, he knew he was in danger. As a former lieutenant colonel in the Russian secret police, who was now openly critical of his former employers, he was bound to be in danger. He had made enemies, plenty of enemies. Even so, when he entered a sushi bar on the 1st of November, he can hardly have expected that this would be the place where the death sentence would be served. For it seems that on that day and in that place, Litvinenko was somehow drugged with the poison that would kill him. When he fell ill a few days later, it took a long time to determine the cause of the trouble. The doctors tried everything to save him, but when they finally realized what the poison was, they knew the case was hopeless. There was nothing they could do but watch him die. Polonium-210 is a radioactive isotope that emits alpha particles. What that means is that outside the body, it is completely harmless. Alpha particles cannot penetrate the skin. But once inside the body, breathed in the air, or ingested with food or drink, it is deadly. There is no way of preventing it from spreading throughout the system, destroying key organs from within. Above a certain radiation dose level, it may work slowly, but it is fatal. Acute radiation sickness is incurable. The symptoms are highly unpleasant, and death is inevitable. And on the 23rd of November, it happened to him. Last Thursday, he was buried in Highgate Cemetery. So what is the point of saying all this today? That you should be careful who you talk to in sushi bars? No, the point is simply this. Death is inevitable for all of us. We may not harbour some hideous radioactive poison attacking our vital organs, but we all have the seeds of death in our system from the day we are conceived. It may work very slowly. We may never give it a thought, especially when we're young. It may even take 100 years to finish us off, but death is inevitable. Coursing through your veins right now is the poison that will kill you. It's not a comfortable thought. But the truth doesn't go away just because we don't like to think about it. Alexander Litvinenko made many enemies in his lifetime. But death is the final enemy, the ultimate enemy that we all have to face. And Jesus has the answer to it. Jesus Christ has victory over death. And in today's story, he proves it. Over the last couple of weeks in Mark's Gospel, we have followed Jesus as he takes on and defeats some of the most hostile powers in the universe. First, there was the life-threatening storm on Galilee, where Jesus is wakened from sleep by his terrified disciples and simply calms the chaotic waves and the wild winds with the words. There he proves that he is Lord of creation, the God who brings order out of chaos and gives peace to his people, whatever storms we may face. From the chaos of the lake, we moved on to the chaos of a man's life, the demonized man in the country of the Gerasenes, his life torn apart by the army of evil spirits who had him in their grip, his whole existence a picture of chaos and misery. And the Lord Jesus drives out the demons and restores the man to the peace he so desperately needs. And he ends the story touring his homeland, telling everyone he meets about all that Jesus has done for him. The hostile powers of nature, the hostile forces of evil. Jesus proves he is the master of them all. And here, now, we see him facing first sickness and then the most feared enemy of all, death itself, and proving that he has the power to heal, the power to bring life. We pick up the story in Mark chapter 5, verse 21. As Jesus once more crosses the lake back to his own area, probably around Capernaum where he's based. At once, and in contrast to the loneliness of the other shore, a great crowd is gathered round him again, as it does every time Jesus appears in Galilee. But very soon there's a special visitor. The crowds part to make way for a distinguished figure in a long robe. The locals all know him. This is Jairus, the official in charge of the local synagogue, an important dignitary. He'd seen Jesus before, there's no doubt about that. He was probably there not long ago when Jesus drove out an evil spirit in his own synagogue. And then there were all those healings that same Saturday night. But today it's his own problems that fill his thoughts. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." Whatever suspicions he may have shared with his colleagues about this new teacher, Jairus has only one problem on his mind right now. Casting his dignity aside, he falls to the ground in front of Jesus and begs him for help. The situation is desperate. His daughter, 12 years old, as we learn later, is at the point of death. Maybe you've been in a situation like that. Maybe you know how he feels. And Jesus goes with him. Probably only a mile or two to his house in the town. But progress is desperately slow as the great crowd relentlessly presses in. Even a moment's delay must be agony for Jairus. And soon there's a much longer one. Will the delay mean that Jesus comes too late? For in the crowd there is another desperate case. Unlike Jairus, she has no dignity to lose. Unlike him, she approaches Jesus secretly, not openly. Verse 25. A woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." My guess is that most men who preach on this passage pass over the woman's condition pretty quickly. We shouldn't. In case it's not clear, this woman has been living with continuous menstruation for 12 years. That kind of problem would be bad enough today. In those times, it would be far, far worse. A woman like this, you see, was in trouble for no less than 5 reasons. One, it's embarrassing, not because people are coy, but because it would make them despise her. She lives with constant shame. 2, it's physically so debilitating. She must live with constant weakness. 3, her desperate attempts to find a cure have driven her into abject poverty. With this condition, she would be poor anyway. But tragically, she's now spent her last reserves on hopeless remedies. History has preserved records of some of the remedies that doctors would use at this time, including carrying around the ash of an ostrich egg wrapped in a special cloth, and drinking wine containing a powder made of rubber, alum, and garden crocuses. The doctors were just as powerless as today's medics to heal Litvinenko, and they've left her in the depths of poverty. 4, she will be physically unable to have children with the bitter disappointment and shame that would bring. But perhaps worse than any of these, 5, she will be ritually unclean all the time. The Jewish law is very clear on these matters. It's all to do with the central importance of blood in the sacrificial system. For blood represented both life and death. The blood of an animal could not be eaten, hence some of the kosher food laws. Blood was special, it was reserved for sacrifice. That's why women were unclean during their periods. Not because the law was down on women, as some people think, but because of the sacredness of blood. But this woman will be unclean all the time. The Jewish scholars typically produced a whole book of rules about how someone like this had to live. It's about that thick. Tractate Zabim of the Mishnah, if you're interested. No one who wants to worship can touch her. She herself can never approach the presence of God, can never enter the temple courts to pray. Just like the man with leprosy we met in chapter 1, she is a permanent outcast. And that's even worse than the poverty and the weakness and the shame. Is it any wonder then that she simply creeps up through the dense, jostling crowd to reach out and touch Jesus' clothes? How could she dare to appear openly? And yes, perhaps there is an element of superstition in her idea that she needs only touch the healer's robe to be healed. But there's a lot of faith as well. Imagine what it has cost her even to emerge from her home and do this much. Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Her healing is immediate, and somehow she knows it. Perhaps there has been constant pain and it suddenly ceased. But more likely, it's not just that the bleeding has stopped, but that all her weakness has been restored to strength in that moment. She feels complete again, strong again, as she has not felt for 12 long and miserable years. Can you imagine? But her story isn't quite finished. Jesus, too, knows something has happened. The touch may have been unconscious, but there has been a cost. He realized that power had gone out from him. Doesn't mean that he now has less power than he had before. But there has been a transaction. She has touched him by faith. There is a relationship between Jesus and the woman. Power has been released. And so he asks, "Who touched me?" To the disciples, the question is ridiculous. Obviously, in a crowd like this, people are touching him all the time. It's like a crowded tube train. Yes, they're all touching him. But not every touch has released his power. Does Jesus really not know who has touched him? Is this all some kind of play acting to draw the woman out of the crowd and make her confess while he really knows all along? He certainly does want to draw her out. But no, he really doesn't know. Jesus, the man on earth, does not know everything except when the Spirit of God reveals it to him. And so he keeps looking round to find out who has done this. Finally, she emerges and, just as Jairus did, falls at his feet and tells him the whole story. She's afraid. She trembles with fear. She knows so little of this man who stands before her. Will he be angry? Will he recoil at the thought that she has dared an unclean outcast to lay a hand on him? And what about these others standing around who can overhear every word? as the story pours out of her. What will they feel? What will they think of her? Even the miracle of healing she has just experienced fills her with fear. Just like the disciples in the boat on Galilee, just like the locals who saw the demoniac restored to his right mind. For the power of God is a fearsome thing. But she need not have worried. Verse 34. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." See what Jesus has done for her. She is healed after 12 years of misery. She has peace after the torment she has known. The agony is over. And once more, he brings in the outsider. Jesus is never bothered about becoming ritually unclean by contact with leprosy, or blood, or death even, because his touch makes everything clean. And now, after her years as an outcast, barred from access to God, he calls her daughter. Think what that means to her. "Daughter, because you've put your faith in me, you're healed, you have peace, you can go." Still, there is another daughter, and for her, it does not look so good. Even as Jairus breathes a sigh of relief that at last they can move on, a delegation from his home appears with the terrible news that his daughter has died. Bringing Jesus home now would be pointless, they say, perhaps betraying their own suspicions of him. Jesus hears what they say, and he doesn't bat an eyelid. Turns to Jairus, says, "Don't be afraid. Just believe." Believe what? He does not say. But they push on, and at last they arrive. Jesus takes with him just the inner circle, Peter, James, and John, on into the house where the girl now lies dead. There's a loud commotion of people crying and wailing. These are the hired mourners demanded by the custom. To judge by the remarkable speed with which they've assembled, the family must have anticipated the girl's death, which means that her last hours alive have been accompanied by the funeral preparations. He went in, verse 39, and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. They ridicule him because they know perfectly well she is dead. They go round mourning for people every day. It's their job. They know what death looks like. But Jesus knows too. And he has the advantage that he knows what's going to happen next. Sleep is something you wake up from, you see. And so is this. So with the mourners banished, the six of them enter the room and look down at the dead body. He took her by the hands and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately, the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. So simple. Again, here's the eyewitness record. Mark alone, informed by Peter, records the original Aramaic words which Jesus speaks as he raises the girl to her feet and to life. Mark tells us they were astonished. Well, that's surprising, isn't it? This girl was dead. Now she's walking about. They're astonished. Of course they are. And Jesus says, "Give her a meal. She's had a hard day. And don't tell anyone." It's hard to believe that instruction is obeyed for long. Far too many people already know about it. Possibly Jesus only means to cover his own withdrawal from the scene before he is mobbed. For 12 years, this girl has lived a privileged life in the home of a respected local official. For 12 years, they've watched her grow. But status and privilege have not protected them from death, the ultimate enemy. At the opposite end of the social scale is the woman in the crowd. If she hadn't had this affliction, she might have had a child now, just the age of Jairus' daughter. 12 years of privileged childhood in one case. 12 years of outcast, childless poverty on the other. Both are far beyond human help. But one Jesus heals, and the other he raises from death. And by the way, do you see how these two stories show the value Jesus places on the lives of women? Whether adults, or 12-year-old girls, or a baby like Eliza. The Lord Jesus has power over death. And what happened in the girl's bedroom that day foreshadows what would happen around 2 years later. Death comes to all, and even Jesus himself would die. But in his case, it would not be by illness or old age. He would die a young man. Jesus' death came when he deliberately laid down his own life voluntarily as a blood sacrifice, taking our place, facing the consequences of our rebellion against God. On the cross, he took our place, paid our penalty, bought us peace with God. Because of the cross, when we believe in him, Jesus can look at us and say, "Daughter, son, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Enjoy peace with God and be free." In the cross, God's power is released to bring peace into human hearts. Peace to a world in chaos. Have you found that peace? And when Jesus died, that too was asleep. Yes, he was dead. There was no doubt about that. But 2 days later, on that triumphant Sunday morning, which we sang about at the start of the service, he burst the bonds of death and rose to life. Death has no more hold on him. And for everyone whose faith is in Jesus, that resurrection guarantees, it absolutely guarantees that we will rise to life as well. That's why the early church persisted in calling it sleep. When Christians died, it wasn't some silly euphemism. It wasn't that they couldn't cope with talking about death. No. They knew that for a Christian, death is something you wake up from to a bright, glad, joyful morning. Do you know that? That's why 25 years later, Paul could write so triumphantly, "Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting?" Because he knew that the Lord Jesus has the power over death, and his resurrection proves it. Paul knew what death looked like. He'd stared it in the face more than once. But he knew that for a Christian, it was a beaten enemy because of Jesus. And there, in the girl's bedroom, because of her father's faith in Jesus, that victory, that power was clearly demonstrated. That victory was seen at work. Do you see who Jesus is? Do you understand what he can do? Look at what these two did, the woman and Jairus. They were desperate. They knew it. Each with a problem that no human power could solve. They didn't know very much about Jesus, but they had enough faith to come to him. See how the woman in the crowd reaches out to touch him. See how Jairus falls at Jesus' feet, because they know Jesus alone can meet their needs. Are you ready to do that? Maybe like the woman, you are hiding in the crowd this morning, afraid to be seen, afraid, and yet drawn to this Jesus, whom you don't fully understand, but you know somehow has the answer to your need. Perhaps you also are afraid of death. Are you willing to trust in the one who has power over death? If you belong to Christ, the death we all fear becomes sleep. We will die, yes, but we die to wake up in his presence. That's the knowledge that is sustaining people in this room now who've lost loved ones who belong to Jesus. Yes, they grieve for their loss. Yes, they are in pain. But they don't grieve like people who have no hope, because they know. Perhaps you've realized that you need to find this peace with God. It's coming home to you that you can't live the life you know you should lead, and all you have behind you is a record of failure. That you've rejected God, that you've lived a life without him. You haven't gone his way, and you need to put that right. Are you willing to trust the one who can save you from that? Jesus died for you so that your guilty past can be dealt with. Your record of sins can be wiped out. And you can face your own death with confidence. Are you going to put your life in his hands? Your background doesn't matter. You may feel like an outcast or proud of your status, dignified like Jairus, resisting any idea of depending on anyone else, but be as proud and dignified as you please. We all have to fall at Jesus' feet. That's where we have to begin. We all start from ground level. If you want to find life, if you want to find peace, if you want to find reality, and then, because of what he has done, because of what Jesus has done, comes hope, comes healing, comes peace, comes life.